Okay, so I said already that I would like to look at the question of letting go, loslassen. And you also have another beautiful word in German, Gelassenheit. And the way that I understand this practice, both play an equal role. The Loslassen and the Gelassenheit. Gelassenheit being, as it were, the fruit of Loslassen. Letting something go allows us to rest in Gelassenheit. We don't have a word in English. I think Gelassenheit is a very beautiful idea. And it fits very well, this model. So, just to sort of remind you of what some of what I said last night, some of what I mentioned this morning, and also an idea that's been running through my writing now for some years, and that is that I see this practice not just as a single activity, like doing a certain kind of meditation or reciting a prayer or something, but actually it's a practice that engages the whole of our humanity. And in this sense, speaking, communicating, what I'm doing now, is just as much part of my practice as when I sit on my bottom here and watch my breath. I don't want to privilege meditation over the other parts of my life. Rather, I seek through this broader concept of practice to integrate the different areas of my activity, my thinking, my speaking, my working, to bring them into a more coherent whole. Ein Ganze. Is that right? A whole. And that is what I think the word, when the Buddha uses this word rechte Ansicht, rechte Absicht, and so on, the word rechte, right, which I'm not happy with as a translation, is in Pali sama, which means something more like complete or whole. We had an enormous problem in translating this term in the recent book, and endless emails were dedicated to trying to clarify what was meant. And I'm not going to bore you with that. But the point I'm trying to make is that sama, rather than thinking of it as right as opposed to wrong, to think of our the way we see things and think and make choices and speak and write and act and work, this is sama, complete, if all of these activities are somehow integrated into a single life. So we don't have the kind of person I am at my office, you know, angry, frustrated, bored, and the kind of person I am at my Buddhist center, mindful, compassionate, etc. These are not two different things. But actually we somehow find a way of bringing our life into some kind of more unified condition. That's how I would understand this practice in the broadest sense. It's about unification, integration of our meditation, of our ethics, and of our philosophy. Now, in terms of the framework, the Zusammenhang of the practice itself, then I found it very helpful to think in terms of these four Aufgaben, these four tasks, to embrace life or dukkha, however we translate that, to let go of reactivity, to behold, to see for oneself the stopping of reactivity, and to cultivate, to bring into being a way of life that includes these eight aspects of the path, this sort of complete life. And these four tasks also are not four separate things. For convenience, for didactic purposes, it's useful to break them up. But in practice, every moment really of our life requires that we work with all four. And in this sense, I almost prefer to speak not of vier Aufgabe, but of ein vierfelte or vierfacher Aufgabe. Ein vierfacher Aufgabe, a fourfold task. So, since I'm the subject here, this means that I seek to be open and to be accepting of you, the audience, the public, and I try to do that in a way that's not conditioned by my reactivity, that I like some of you and I don't like others of you, and I'd much rather be doing something else than being in Heidelberg today. That's my reactive mind. I'd rather be having an afternoon siesta rather than giving this talk. That's all the stuff that comes up, which I try to let go of, which is what we're going to look at. I try to speak from a still, calm, non-reactive space that I'm aware of in myself. That's the third aspect of this task. And fourthly, I'm talking. I'm practicing vacha, a speech, hopefully right speech, or integrated speech in that way. So the speech, if it is to be samavacha, if it is to be complete or integrated speech, would be one that is also integrated into this process of embracing, letting go, seeing the stopping of reactivity, being still and calm, and living my life from that responsive rather than reactive perspective. Is that clear? More or less. If you want to know more about it, there's a very good book for sale downstairs, which I go into this in quite some detail. Okay, so what I want to look at this afternoon is the second aspect of this task, which is letting go of craving. It's usually translated in English as abandoning craving. Pahana or pahajati is often translated as to abandon. You know what that means, abandon? It means to reject, basically, to get rid of. And I think it's way too strong. It feels as though we want to deny something of ourselves. We want to destroy something. And I don't think that is actually what this is about at all. It's much too close to what we would otherwise call aversion or hatred. Abandoning craving is like hating craving and wanting to sort of destroy it. And that to me is a kind of violence, in fact. But let's think this through a little bit more carefully. This letting go of reactivity, which is letting go of craving, hatred, fear, egoism, pride, all of these, what the Buddhists call these negative, destructive emotions, these kilesa, these asava, many words in Pali for them. It's really, how do we live with these things? How do we work with these forces, these instincts, these drives. I think the first thing, and this is particularly the case in a secular Buddhist approach, is to be clear as to what is the nature of hatred and fear and craving. Where do these things come from? Why do we find ourselves taken over by these desires and fears and hates? We don't choose, or very rarely do we choose to hate. We find ourselves hating. We find ourselves craving. Craving and hatred and so forth happen to us. It's not as though we're sitting around with nothing to do and we say, hey, I think I'll go and hate someone. You don't do that. Well, at least I don't. Maybe I'm weird and you do. But the strange thing is that we see this very clearly in meditation, in just being still and watching what's going on, is we notice that suddenly, without any plan, you're filled with this emotion. And sometimes it takes several minutes before you even notice it. These emotions are so powerful, they invade us. So you're sitting there watching your breath, listening to the pretty song of the birds, and the next thing you know, 10 minutes has disappeared. And you kind of suddenly come to consciousness again, and you realize you've been involved in this fantasy, this daydream, sometimes very emotionally charged. But what's interesting is that for those 10 minutes, you haven't really been conscious. You have been taken over. You have been possessed. And much of the language, the mythological language, both in Buddhism and in other traditions, talks of these things as like being taken over by the devil, Mara in Buddhism. It happens to you. There, in the Jungian psychology, Jung defines a neurosis as an autonomous complex in the psyche. Ein autonomischer Komplex der Psyche. Is that right? Autonomous complex in the psyche. Now that's a very interesting observation, because Jung understood that neurosis is not something you choose. Neurosis, in a sense, has its own, it seems to operate independently of you. And when that becomes pathological, like, for example, chronic anxiety or panic attacks, you realize you're actually unable to manage or control these emotions that invade you. So you need to go to a therapist, and nowadays you do an MBSR course. But MBSR is basically just another way to deal with this stuff. But it's coming from a very similar understanding of the human condition, that we are subject to these things. But because we're very egotistical, we also identify with them. We think, I am angry, or I'm an angry person. You actually invest your identity in these things. And it seems very difficult, therefore, if you really are an angry person, to ever free yourself from anger. It's part of who you are. So the approach we take, first of all, needs to acknowledge that these are things that happen to us. We don't choose them. They're not mine. They're not me or mine. They're impersonal. Again, another very basic Buddhist understanding is anatta, not so. These things are not you. They're not me. So where do they come from? For me, the most compelling explanation for the origin of greed and hatred and so on is that they come from our own evolution as animals. They come from the forces of the biological forces that have enabled our ancestors to survive and evolve and adapt and to end up as us. So we are the end result of millions of years of greed, hatred, and delusion. In other words, the people who survived were those in the past who could pass on their genetic materials. In other words, they could reproduce, they could have children. Nowadays, that's fairly straightforward. In the old days, it was a matter of life and death. And so the people who got to survive were the ones who were good at getting what they wanted. They were good at getting rid of whatever stood in their way. And they had a strong sense of self and a wish for that self to keep existing, either in your own body or in the body of your children or your families. Now, this is a view that's taken entirely from evolutionary biology, and in fact a subset of that would be evolutionary psychology. And this fits remarkably well with the Buddhist analysis. In other words, greed, hatred, delusion correspond to the primary instinctual drives that push the process of survival forward. So what we're dealing with in meditation is effectively the legacy of our evolution. But we get to a point in evolution where we, human societies, achieve a certain degree of stability. We start to create forms of government and social structures, and we have managed now to pretty much have enough to eat, have a law and order in the society. We don't need greed, hatred, and delusion as much as we did in the past. They've become superfluous to need, unnecessary. And yet they're still very much part of who we are. So all religions, all practical philosophies, all psychotherapy are basically ways of coming to terms with, of dealing and managing the legacy of our past. Now, in traditional Buddhism, we don't look at it this way at all. Greed and hatred and delusion are understood as aspects of the mind and that have been driving us from birth to birth to birth to birth since beginningless time. Greed, hatred, delusion, or in a more succinct term, tanha, craving. Craving is what drives rebirth. And so that's what keeps perpetuating the cycle of birth and death. Now, although these are very different world pictures, at one level they're saying something very similar. They're both acknowledging that these are forces that either emerged from millions of years of physical evolution, or millions of years of going round the cycle of rebirth. But they both identify the same basic forces. So at some level, it doesn't really matter which picture you hold. But I feel that in our time, we're able to have an understanding of these things that probably is more convincing, because there seems to be a huge amount of empirical evidence for it. There's very little empirical evidence for rebirth and karma and so on, but there's plenty of evidence for the forces that drive evolution. Now this leads us, in traditional Buddhism, the idea is that because these things are just part of the mind, then if you transform the mind, you'll get rid of these things. They'll disappear. From a secular Buddhist perspective, if we recognize that these forces are part of our evolution, our physical evolution, then we're going to be stuck with them. They're basically built into the limbic system, as I've been told by biologists. They're part of our brain system, our nervous system. So I don't think it matters how much meditation you do. You're probably not going to have a major impact on the structure of your nervous system. You can make certain changes, you can make it maybe less fraught, but the basic stuff will still be around. So when we say, let go of hatred, let go of craving, we're not saying get rid of, because that's not really an option. They're going to be there at some point, whatever we do, however enlightened we are. We're still basically, the products of our animal parts. So what then does it mean to let go? To let go means, first of all, to acknowledge and recognize and say yes. So that's actually the first Aufgabe, the first task, is to embrace the situation we're in, which is how we're feeling, the situation of other people and the environment we're in at that time, to be able to embrace that, but also to embrace our own reactions to what's happening. So that's the first step in letting go, is to say yes to greed and hatred and egoism and pride and so on. To recognize that these are entirely natural consequences of the kind of beings that we are. There's nothing wrong with feeling fear or hatred or desire. This, I think, is a crucial element also in Buddhist ethics. Okay? Ethics or morality doesn't begin with the first moment of hatred, say. Hatred arises. You have no role in that. You didn't choose to hate. It arose within you. It's at that point not a moral or ethical condition. It only becomes an ethical condition when we decide, either by habit or by choice, to actually act on that hatred, to act on that selfish desire, to assent to that. To say, yeah, I can't stand that person, I'm going to do this or that or the other. Then we're in ethics. Mindfulness of hatred or desire itself is pre-ethical. In other words, it's simply stepping back and being aware and noticing, oh, anger has arisen. That's not a problem. We can make it into a problem, but at that point, it's just what the organism is throwing up. There's nothing wrong with that at all. You don't have to feel guilty that you feel these things at all. Mindfulness, awareness, Achtsamkeit, is about opening up a space within ourselves whereby we can see these things for what they are, and we can choose not to act on them. That is letting go. Letting go is effectively a choice we make not to follow that emotion. So you've probably noticed in the meditations we were doing this morning that every now and again something rushed up within you. You probably didn't notice it. You were probably not very mindful at that moment. And the next thing you knew, you're being carried off by it. So as we train ourselves in mindfulness, we train ourselves to get closer and closer to the beginning, the first arising of that emotion or desire or fear or whatever, so that we catch it earlier and earlier in the process. And the earlier we catch it, the less power it will have to overwhelm us. In Shantideva, he's an 8th century Mahayana Buddhist monk, he says it's like a poisoned arrow. He says once the arrow penetrates the skin, then its poison will spread through the system very quickly. And in the same way, he says, when a kilesa, when a negative thought arises, very quickly it will spread through the system. It will take us over. We become kind of toxic. And we notice, I notice this in meditation a lot, that if I let certain thoughts or emotions take hold, once they've got a hold of me, it's very difficult to do much about it. You even feel sometimes, you know, your heart accelerates, you sweat, you get shaky, and you can't just switch that off. You have to let that then sort of wind down, play itself out. So the idea with awareness practice is to see these things as they happen and allow them to just do their thing. And their thing, as conditioned impermanent states of mind, is to arise, stay around for a bit, and pass away. That's what they'll do. And so what I think is the genius of this approach, which the Buddha seems to have figured out by himself, is that what you do is nothing. You don't do anything. Letting go is basically letting be. So Loslassen is actually Seinlassen. Seinlassen. You let it be. You allow it to just pass away in its own time, of its own accord. You don't have to do anything at all, like push it down or push it away or abandon it, as they say. There's no need to do that. You just, again, I go back to Shantideva. Some of you might have heard of him. Shantideva says, you should remain like wie ein Stück Holz, like a piece of wood. He says, whenever greed arises, whenever this arises, whenever that arises, shing shindu neraja in Tibetan, remain like a piece of wood. And what that means is that if you're just a piece of wood, then whether something beautiful comes in front of you, or something ugly, something dangerous, something safe, the wood does not react a bit like your tree. In fact, remain like a tree. Now, this is not a recipe for how to live your life as a whole. It's because that would be a rather terrible kind of life if you just tried to be like a tree for the next 50 years. I'll just be like a tree. No, it's a specific tactic to deal with the uprising of destructive emotion. You just observe it as it is and you let it go. So letting go then leads to Gelassenheit. Gelassenheit, I've seen it sometimes translated as equanimity, but since you're German, we don't have to go down this particular track because you all know what it means. The consequence of letting go is to allow you to come to rest in a still, equanimous awareness of what's taking place, in which you begin to notice that there's a part of you that is not reactive. That the mindfulness of, let's say, hatred is itself not hating. Your awareness of desire is not desire. So even in the moment of attention, seeing these things, you're already free from them. As you bring consciousness into this, and you've already changed the situation. The problem is that consciousness is usually overridden, and we find ourselves just propelled by these emotions to think and speak and act in certain ways. It clouds our judgment, it obscures our vision, and it makes it very difficult to free ourselves from these powers. So mindfulness is really just another way of saying consciousness. We allow ourselves to be conscious of these things. And in doing so, we start to become conscious of the non-reactive quality of consciousness itself. When you're just paying attention, you're already free from reactivity, craving, etc. And so the third Aufgabe is to actually learn to taste and to savor and to enjoy and to feel that non-reactive dimension of your own experience. And that non-reactive experience, even if it only lasts for a few moments, if it lasts for longer, is, I would argue, nirvana. That is nirvana. Now again, this would be major heresy in most Buddhist traditions, but it actually is there in the very earliest suttas, discourse. The Buddha describes nirvana, he defines nirvana very simply, as the absence of greed, the absence of hatred, and the absence of delusion. Well, actually, it's not so much absence, the word is kaya, which means ending, the ending of greed, ending of hatred, ending of delusion. Now many people, many Buddhists, have understood that to mean when you get to a very evolved and enlightened state of mind, greed and hatred and delusion are gone forever. And that is the sort of the grand vision of nirvana, a life without any greed or hatred or delusion. But it's clear from how this word is used in the early teachings that it doesn't just refer to some final hypothetical perfection. It refers to every moment in life when greed or hatred or delusion have come to a stop. If, let's say, hatred arises, and we observe that, we can also observe it come to a stop. And the moment at which it stops is a moment of nirvana. So we have to take nirvana off its pedestal and bring it back to where it truly belongs. And where it truly belongs is right here in our own heart. Now, another way that this is expressed in the early texts is where the Buddha describes nirvana, as sanditiko, which means clearly visible. He describes it as akaliko, which means immediate, unmittelbar. He describes it as ehipasiko, inviting. It calls us forth. He describes it as opanaiko, uplifting, dignifying. And he describes it as something which is experienced by the wise, not experienced by the Buddhists, experienced by the wise. So nirvana is not some exclusive Buddhist attainment. It's actually a capacity that any wise person would understand. It's that capacity we have to dwell in Galasanheit, and arguably nirvana equals Galasanheit. It's clearly visible. In other words, you can see it with your own eyes. It's those moments in your life when you are resting in a non-reactive awareness. You don't have to be a meditator, you don't have to be a Buddhist, you don't have to be a religious or spiritual person to know that human life has moments in which you find yourself at peace. In ordinary everyday situations, when you're in nature, when you're in love, many, many occasions, you find yourself in this state of inner repose. And there's something that we all humans value in that. To live at peace in the deepest sense means to create, is to live in these, in this non-reactive space of mind where you are content with what's going on. You are at rest, and also the world is opened up for you as something beautiful, mysterious, inspiring. That's the experience of nirvana. And nirvana, therefore, is the third of these four tasks. It's to behold, to experience, to enjoy those moments of stillness, this galasanheit. So letting go, we can now, I think, see quite easily, is what creates the condition for us to come to rest in galasanheit. But galasanheit is not the goal of the path. This is again where my secular interpretation of Buddhism is in conflict with traditional Buddhism, which maintains that nirvana, is the goal of the path. The noble Eightfold Path, which leads to nirvana. I'm suggesting it's the other way around. That the Noble Eightfold Path arises from nirvana. In other words, it's when the mind has reached a still, non-reactive awareness that we are then free to think and speak and act and work in a way that's not conditioned by greed, selfishness, hatred, and so on. In this sense, nirvana is an ethical condition. It's a space that affords us the possibility of choosing to live differently. It's a life in which we're not driven by social pressure, psychological habit, religious belief, but we're free to respond to the situation we find ourselves in a way that's not determined by those kinds of conditioned belief and behavior and so on. And that's what leads us into the Eightfold Path. I think that's all I really want to say. Are there anything you would like to... Does this, by the way, address your question? Not really.
Not really, no.
No.
But I could ask you some clarification on the step in between. You said that once we are aware of either hatred, sadness, greed, or whatever, there's already a tiny part that is not identified with the feeling,
right.
And that is the starting point to let go of that.
That's right, yes, exactly.
And then we just have to wait, watching it rise maybe a little further, and then add down. And because I find it very... Actually, it happens not that often to me that I really notice the point where feeling stops.
Mm-hmm.
So the point that you would call nirvana.
Well, no, that's a good point. I'm speaking in a somewhat theoretical mode.
Yeah.
In actual life, we don't have the luxury to wait for these things to fizzle out, right? If we're in, let's say, a meeting with colleagues and we start feeling anger arising, we can't say to our colleagues, wait, I've got to go and meditate for a bit and then I'll come back and when this anger has passed away, then I'll come back and we'll continue the conversation. Obviously, you can't do that. And I think also these things are happening with such rapidity that we have very little control, if any, over their arising. So in other words, this attentive awareness of these things, this mindfulness of these things, is something we can experience that is not reacting. The mindfulness of the anger is not angry. So we identify, as it were, with that awareness, that non-reactive awareness, even when the reaction is bubbling around. So this is, again, a very important part of mindfulness meditation. Is not to think that you can only be mindful when the mind is still and calm. You need to be mindful even when the mind is most turbulent and disturbed. And what that leads to is the awareness that recognize that this non-reactive awareness is present even in the midst of all of this reactivity. So you can be with these things, but not of them. And that means that you have the freedom to act in an unangry way, even when you're aware that you're angry, if that makes sense. And it's in that way, I think, that we get round this, this very valid point, that if we were to take this too literally, then we'd never get round to doing much at all. We'd be too busy waiting for all this stuff to stop.
Yeah. Yes, it's a similar question I get. As you said, it's a point of time, how much time you have to react. But I would think it's also another aspect, is because when you... Is it really sufficient just to be able to let go if you see the subject? And could you let go, or is it important to have other skills or other, modes of acting, let's say to another person or anything like this? So probably what I would like to ask you, are there other skills necessary to be able to let go in these situations?
Yes. Yes, there are. Let me just try to think of a few examples. First of all, you have to be motivated to let go. You have to have a good reason to think this is a good idea. And I think it's important, therefore, to reflect not only on, as it were, the technology that I'm describing, but also, more importantly, why it's a good idea to live this way. What's wrong with, I get a nice kick out of being angry, and I get my way, and blah, blah, blah. You can have all sorts of reasons for doing it. So.
Exactly. There are also ways to get, like in German, the phrase, to get rid of the anger. This is quite the contrary of what...
Yeah, it is. It is. You see, I think what you use to express the anger.
Right.
In the first instance, if you're feeling angry, to release the anger feels great. Right? It feels really wonderful. Because there's certain pressure and tension of being released, and you've expressed yourself, you've been very clear about your feelings. That may be an appropriate way to respond in some situations. I would make a distinction between anger and hatred, but that's a little bit academic. But the point is that this releasing of anger already suggests that you've let it build up inside you to some point where it's becoming more and more intolerable. You just can't hold it in anymore. So you've already behaved in such a way that's... You've let this build up, build up, build up, build up, and then bang, it explodes. And of course, it's a nice release. But going back to my earlier point, let's say, for example, you make a choice that I don't want to live in a world, I don't want to behave that way. I don't want to be someone who's always blowing up and exploding and people are really nervous around me because they don't know when I'm going to freak out. In other words, ultimately it comes down to your vision of what kind of person you want to be. And that's an ethical question. Who are the sort of people in history, in my life, that I really admire and honor? And that gives you a sense of the kind of person you would prefer to be. I want to live a life in which I don't... upset people too much, in which I don't constantly get into arguments, in which I'm not always in opposition with people, I'm always emotional. That's not the way I want to live. I've lived that way and I didn't like it. And so this kind of philosophy starts by us thinking, no, I don't want to live that way anymore. I don't want to just be driven by these drives and instincts. I'd rather live a more conscious, a reasonable, and ethical life that's hopefully more wise, more kind, more caring. So if we consciously start thinking along those lines, And I suspect you wouldn't have come here today if you didn't think in that way. Then it's that ethical vision of the sort of person I want to be that informs your deepest motivations. So in other words, if you really are committed to trying to transform yourself, trying to somehow become, you know, a better person, for lack of a better word, that will give you the motive to not let all this anger build up inside you in the first place. You'll hopefully become more skilled at managing your anger so that it never really develops a strong power within you. You don't let it accumulate. So those kinds of, the idea of releasing anger becomes less and less of an issue because you just don't let it get to that point so much. I mean, sometimes it might still happen. I mean, frankly, yeah, I get really pissed off sometimes. I get angry. And sometimes, in fact, I got angry with someone the other day. Someone in a talk I gave in Paris was asking the really most stupid question. And I got so fed up. I got quite angry, actually. I was surprised. I didn't feel terribly good about it. But again, I try to internalize that into my own self-understanding, into my own behavior, see my own weak spots. Again, we're not aiming at perfection. We're basically trying out a set of methods, of skills, that together might work towards realizing those kind of ethical goals that one has. So, motivation is a very important part of it. I think another important aspect is to become more conscious of your mortality, to realize that we don't have long on this earth. And how can we, you know, best spend our time here? Again, it goes back to motive, it goes back to vision, but it also gives you a sense of how precious life is. If you really knew that the person you were getting angry with was going to have a stroke the next day, you probably would behave very differently, I would suspect. So it's this, all of these reflections, the philosophy that lies behind it, the reflection on value and meaning, they all contribute to this practice. And going back to your question this morning about MBSR. See, MBSR doesn't deal with this kind of stuff. It deals with the technique. But it doesn't bring in these larger ethical and philosophical questions. People who do MBSR might then take an interest in those things. But in and of itself, it's stripped away from the framework that you'd find in Buddhist practice. Another practice that would be helpful here would be the cultivation of metta, loving kindness, compassion, to really work on those qualities, to value them. And again, if you've got used to really trying to generate a sense of well-being, you know, may others be happy, may they not suffer. If you really consciously cultivate those feelings, it'll be. You're not going to get angry in the same way. Or if you are, it'll be less short-lived. Or if you do, you'll feel it's in conflict with what you really would like to feel. So that would be another practice. I think most meditations would contribute to this process. I still want to go back to your question. The thing, so in other words, I was trying to actually address your point. First of all, hatred and desire and so on, if they come from deep within us, are always going to be around. The idea that one day we'll get to zero anger, unlikely. But things like, especially when it becomes more pathological, like depression, anxiety perhaps, these are things we may simply have to learn to live with, rather than feel that we can let them go. And so when we talk of letting go, it's quite important to identify what that refers to. What is let goable of? And what possible effect that might have. The Buddha's not saying to let go of suffering or to let go of depression. That's probably not something you can let go of. Those things will, you can have a different relationship to them, but the chances are they won't just arise and pass away. They're more deeply rooted in our experience. So at that level, it refers, the practice would be a greater kind of self-acceptance, largely. But I find the two go hand in hand. The embracing of one's condition, the accepting of who you are, and the letting go of those habits and drives and forces that drive you into acting in ways that you subsequently regret. And that can be something you can do about, but again, that's ethical. I think the changes we can make are ethical changes.
Yes. Does that mean that I have to develop some kind of permanent observer, which is, sounds very like stress, always observes what I'm feeling and so on, so and he rings the alarm, but okay, just be careful, you're getting angry, because I know for myself that things like anger or desires come very, very spontaneously.
That's right.
From one moment to the other, right. I'm very, very much confessed that my neighbor, he has a reason why he's still on the balcony and is still talking, and I want to sleep. And I give him just another quarter of an hour and another quarter of an hour, and he will go inside, and all of a sudden I crash and I shout over the street and ask him, "Could you please?" Yeah? And so, and then he never talks to me again. So, I made a mistake, obviously. And should I have this permanent observer? What would change?
That's a good point. I think when we first start doing these kinds of exercises, we kind of have to adopt a somewhat artificial perspective. And as you say, we try to cultivate a sort of permanent watcher or observer. But if that became... But that is only useful to a certain point. And in fact, what happens over time, I feel, is that permanent observer becomes internalized so that it's just a kind of sensibility. It's just second nature, as we say in English. You don't have to always think there's a judge in the back of your head that's sort of judging everything you do. That's not going to be so helpful. And as you say, it somehow would inhibit another thing that we value, and that is spontaneity. If you look at the Zen tradition, for example, it's all about acting on the moment. It's about responding immediately to a situation in what might seem a rather paradoxical way. You see it also in art. In artists, in a sense, are just responding to something that then becomes a painting or a poem. And if they had a judge in the back of their head saying, well, that's not a good word, or no, you should be a little bit more careful there, that would totally compromise the creative, imaginative process. Likewise in ethics, or in, let's say, therapy. If you're a therapist and you're sitting with your client and you've got another therapist in the back of your head who's analysing you, you would never really engage with the person. If you're in a... Like when I'm talking to you now, I'm trying to just respond to what you said, and I look in your eyes and I try to engage with you, and I try to do that without thinking, without judging. So that's, I think, probably equally, if not more important than, you know, having an observer who judges you as to whether you're mindful or not. So at some level, these practices need to become part of the way we behave. And the training is really to be able to do these things without self-consciously thinking that we're doing these things. It's just what we do. I don't think the Dalai Lama is, you know, he has to think, oh God, another day, another, I've got to be compassionate all day. He just does it. You know, he just, it's spontaneous and it's joyful. So the real challenge is, how do we move from one kind of spontaneity? Like, I can be spontaneously angry and proud and all that stuff, no problem. How do we move from that to a spontaneity which arises from a non-reactive organism as opposed to a reactive one? And that's where the training comes in, the formal practice comes in. You know, the hours on the cushion, going on retreats. That's the training period. But in the end, if the training is successful, you can leave it behind. It's done its work. It's like the raft the Buddha spoke of. Gets you to the other shore, and you leave it there. Off you go. That's the goal, I think, is to actually let go of Buddhism and mindfulness and all of this stuff. Once they have served their purpose, then you get on with living your life. And I think that's a good point to stop.